This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Ruslan, today we have BFM's very own Umapagan Umke Pakan.
Hello, Cam.
And we have the return of, after a very long time, and we're not going to see her again for a very long time after
just
this.
Just a year.
Curator, yes. Ong Jolene.
Hello.
By the way, folks, yes, I've lost my voice a bit. I had a bit of a, I'm having or had a bit of a cold, but I'm very brave, and I'm soldiering on.
Hardest working man in radio.
Yeah, yeah. So our three topics this week will be cultural relativism in the age of outrage, coping mechanisms with poverty, and finally, topic number three will be the removal of statues. So, Uma, cultural relativism.
Yes.
In the age of outrage.
So, I recently watched this fantastic documentary called Tokyo Idols. And it's essentially about, I guess, the otaku culture in Japan. For those of you who don't know, it's there are these young girls, and they start often, sometimes as young as like 11 and 12, to become what are called idols. They sing, they dance, they perform at these concerts, which range from little ones at bars all the way to massive stadium-sized concerts. And the vast majority of their fans, I mean 99% of their fans, are men who are about maybe three times their age sometimes. We're talking 50 and above, right? And so it's a culture that's very prevalent in Japan, and from an outsider's perspective, it can seem rather creepy and untoward. And yet, when I was watching this movie, this documentary, never once was that word pedophilia ever brought up. Or even if they were talking about, I guess, the sexual connotations of it, it was very quickly brushed aside by the parties involved. And I say parties involved, including the parents of these children, who are often like, oh, well, you know, I too was creeped out by the old men initially, but then I realized they're actually like father figures and they want to look after them. And so it's an interesting cultural phenomenon that happens in Japan. Now, these men as well who follow these idols, psychologically, I guess studies have shown and surveys have shown that they don't necessarily have the most healthy relationships themselves, in the sense that, you know, they often don't talk to women in real life. They don't have proper relationships or families or children of their own. And it could be, I don't know, this is me extrapolating, but it could be part of the reason why the birth rate in Japan is so low, right? Because this has become such an accepted norm.
But Uma, the age of outrage, though.
So, yes, bringing it back to the age of outrage, and I was speaking to the director of the film, and I asked her, I said, what was it like on shoot? And she said, well, I was the only Japanese person on shoot. Everyone else with me was a Westerner. And there was immediate outrage, and they could not understand how I was attempting objectivity or not taking a moral stand against this behavior, which was completely unacceptable. And yet, I asked her what the debate was in Japan and whether there was any debate about, you know, what's happening, how it's affecting these individuals. Because, you know, these old men are spending tons of money on this thing as well, right? Driving themselves to bankruptcy. And she was like, no, there's zero debate in Japan. There's zero conversation in the public about otaku culture and whether or not it's damaging to society in any way.
Jolene, well, you're a Japanophile.
A little bit.
Yeah,
yes.
A lot. I mean, you look Japanese.
Okay, yes. Well, I think it's important not to just go back to cultural relativism to defend certain things. Only because sometimes, not just looking at Japan, but like even ourselves, sometimes things are so normalized within our own sphere that we don't realize what may be wrong or what could be better. And in terms of the conversation or the debate in Japan, I think there is conversations about it, but maybe because it's so normalized or it's so popular, it hasn't really surfaced to a certain level. But it is present. And maybe the danger really is, like, on one hand, I think some people feel that it's a form of an outlet. It's an innocent harm, and it's a good commerce. You know, the girls do grow up to be women and have some careers. Although, then the other side is that they expire by the time they're 30. And then
Correct.
How do you, and maybe this is what's leading them to have weird, dysfunctional relationships in real life.
It's also an ancient tradition, is it not?
It stems from not necessarily the otaku culture. I mean, you can track it back to different incarnations. But yes, this is a very new thing that's kind of fueled by the internet and streaming and all.
Well,
of
if you
want to
look at incarnations further back, then that's almost worldwide. That you can buy companionship and time and the body of women.
But I mean, on the metro in Tokyo, because you know I've traveled there as one does. You know, I would see people reading manga. And the manga that they're reading is really quite explicit stuff. And you're just sort of reading it in public like it's no big deal. Cultural relativism, you know, I should not be shocked.
So, yeah, and that's the reason I bring it up, because as I was watching this film and thinking about how I would probably review this movie, and I don't mean cultural relativism as a justification for a wrong, but rather how I need to constantly remind myself to check myself.
Right, right.
Because it's very easy for me to fall into that trap. I remember reading some Western reviews of Singtat's Lucky Harapan Dunia,
yeah.
And they thought it was homophobic and racist. Because of the Orang Minya and certain, I guess, gay jokes that they were making in the film. Yeah. However, when I watched the movie and I understood the cultural nuance, there was a nuance in the jokes as well. It wasn't just straight up homophobia. You know, it was kampong talk, if you will.
But it did repeat and play on these sort of like accepted cultural jokes that are laced with a tinge of racism or colorism, if you want to call
it. It did, but at the same time, the movie had also painted those characters as being simpletons.
So what's worse, that you painted kampong folk as simpletons, or that we think it's okay to make orang minyak joke because they're dark?
But not all of them, right? So there was a wide range of characters, and so you had your simpleton, you had your intellectual, you had your religious guy, and so everyone kind of played a part in that story. It's not that all the kampong people were simpletons. So when you look at that context, you know, it wasn't racist or homophobic. At least it didn't occur to me to be that way. And so I look at that in the same way when I'm watching Tokyo Idols. I'm like, no, I should check myself and then not immediately jump to judgment and try and see things from this perspective. And I have this problem, I guess, when I'm critiquing works that are outside of my understanding or cultural experience, right?
So how should I teach me? How should I be?
I don't know. And
where is that? So how does this come back to Age of Outrage?
It's an Age of Outrage because all of us... It's very easy when you watch Tokyo Idols to get immediately outraged at what is going on.
And now that you have Facebook, anything, yeah. You can just come up and spew outrage.
Correct. And I look at it, and you know, I host at the movies with my friend Ian McNally, and he has this thing called the 360 degrees of BS, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what we see on Facebook all the time, which is essentially someone will go, oh, I agree with you, but Nazis. I agree with you, but feminism. And, you know, so eventually everyone builds on these 360 degrees of outrage, and it completely derails the conversation a lot of time without considering,
but maybe
I guess,
there's
context
also
and cultural conversation and all that stuff.
But perhaps there's also relativism within that. Like, say, for example, the panel that this Kuala Lumpur Festival organized. Were you part of that?
That's another rabbit hole.
It's not.
We need to move on, though, Jolene.
Okay.
Because
that's a whole other segment itself.
I will make a note that this was not picked up here.
That's right. Take it up with management.
Oh, no. I think my Facebook friends will take it up with you later on, maybe.
Oh, my goodness. Not them. So there's no answer to this cultural relativism. But we're going to, in the similar kind of vein.
Yes.
Coping mechanisms with in-your-face poverty. Jolene.
Yeah, so I just came back from a trip to Manila. It was my first time to any place in the Philippines. And there was quite very visible and high amount of urban poor in the city. And working in the line that I work in, which is, contemporary art, visual arts, I was also surrounded by, the privilege that, you know, sort of where I come from, kind of middle class, and even working with people who are more well off, people who can, say, fund an exhibition, fund projects, big
rich
businesses.
People.
Yeah, rich people. And the question was, how do we deal with this?
Yeah.
And
did you find a way?
I don't think I truly tried to deal with it. It would be disingenuous to say that I did. I went there. I was very much a tourist in that sense. I saw, and I don't know. Can you say you feel sorry without
subjectivizing
people? Yeah, okay, I just did that.
But Uma, you spend a lot of time in India.
Yes, with my parents.
With your parents.
It's not easy.
I mean, I'm
how to deal with these things.
We're talking about your parents or poverty?
But poverty in general. My parents are all right. They're kind of cool. But no, it's not easy dealing with poverty. And I think the only way is to... We find ways and means in which we can justify it to ourselves based on what we do. So if we're walking down the street and you close an eye or you ignore the poverty around you, you justify it to yourself by going, oh, well, you know, I gave to charity or I support this organization that helps the homeless. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the way that most of us cope with these things. I volunteer at a soup kitchen because it's overwhelming. There's no way that you can fix this problem by yourself.
But what about the locals? How, I mean, because Malaysia is...
A very large middle class, yes.
Large middle class. We don't really encounter kind of in-your-face street poverty.
Well, as soon as you leave our urban centres, you will. I mean, in a bigger way. I mean, there's still a lot of poverty when you walk around, even Jalan Tun Kol Rahman and
But it's
Brickfields.
Not, but it's not as obvious.
Yes, it's not as obvious.
And there's also not as much separation, I think. We have a large street food culture.
Correct.
And, you know, you can have someone pulling up in a BMW to your favourite nasi lemak ayam goreng stall, and then you and me would be there too, and then, you know, people who are making a bit less are there too. And no one really bats an eye. No one really looks surprised. And
I think in Manila?
Not so much. They don't really have a street food culture there. What I was told is that not recently anyway, the government has been cleaning it up, and I think it's largely to do with maybe a certain aspiration kind of lifestyle. Like, you want to clean it up so that the idea is that people can have something to aspire to, like eat at a better place, you know, instead of like keep looking at the street, which I think is another dangerous slippery slope.
But keeping
things separate, I think that's not a way of dealing with poverty.
How do the local Filipinos, how do local Indians cope with it? Because if it's every day, you must become immune.
It feels like they ignore it because, at least in India, it feels like the middle class Indians like walk on the street and just get on with their lives. They drive in their cars and they're not really paying attention to the people around them who might be poor. And also, I guess the beggars who you would come in contact with don't necessarily try to get money from the locals, right? Mm. They're pursuing the tourists or people who they assume aren't local or part of the city. And I think, but that's a I don't want to say, use the word strategy, but that's something that's used by, I guess, beggars all over the world as well. When you go to Cambodia or actually even in KL to a certain extent. I mean, except for the people who are trying to sell you stuff at Mamak's and stuff like that. But they're trying to sell you something, tissue paper or pencils or something. But the people who are just minta sedekah, for example, in India and stuff, they're not harassing the locals. I think they know, no, we're not going to get anything from them. Let's target the people who we think we're going to get stuff from.
Yeah, there will always be people, like even myself, who, you know, you walk in the streets and you almost, it's like normal, right? You turn a blind eye. Or you may choose to give a couple of loose change to the street kids. But I do have friends as well who are artists, and they've taken a conscious step where, you know, art isn't just about the object. And I think that's very relevant in the place where they're at. And they run projects like Kadamai, where they try to occupy certain like abandoned houses and to provide housing for the urban poor. And then recently I was there, I joined my friends who did a cookout for the people who were displaced in Mindanao. Yeah, and they house them in a hostel within the university grounds. So people do deal with it.
Yeah.
But in a day-to-day life, then, yeah, you kind of have to have a certain separation as well.
And I think actually one of the ways for Malaysians to deal with it is to ignore it as well. Because we do have poverty here. In downtown KL, in areas like Chowkit, etc., it's often hitting a lot of older people who haven't been able to save money. So there are soup kitchens there, and they're seeing a lot of older clients. They call their patrons clients. And local governments have succeeded in finding a way to make sure that we don't actually ever see these things. And it's a two-way thing. We want them to shield us from these sites, and they willingly oblige to keep it away.
Yeah, and I think this is also, like recently there was an article in Jacobin magazine where they talk about the mistake of creative cities. Like, you want to move the creative class in, and then you can have these like placemaking festivals, and you have art festivals that cater to middle class kids like myself, and then you go to somewhere like maybe Medan Pasar. So how are they going to change Medan Pasar now? It's a question, not a judgment, that because they've had something good. So on top of like festivals that may cater for the middle class, and you're sort of bringing people into different places so that you don't keep like, okay, middle class hang out here and then ghetto is there. Ben, I think someone also organized like a film screening that was in the language of like the migrant workers, maybe the Bangladeshis. Yeah, so that was cool. Then the film screening caters to the migrant workers as well.
Yeah.
I think that's one way to deal with it.
I know. I'm showing sort of a Noel Coward movie or something. I don't see why not. It'd be fun.
Mm. Yeah, but I think we do well to help the mass situation when it comes to poverty, right? So the soup kitchens, you know, we'll donate to that, or you know, provide shelter to masses of displaced people. And I think we're often at a conflict on how to handle the individuals that we come across,
and
we don't know how to help them, and that we very easily close a blind eye to because we don't know how to handle that.
And how much of our personal privilege are we willing to let go?
Let go, correct. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, so that's, well, I don't know. I didn't get any lessons there for me. Again, I'm not being taught anything.
No solutions. No solutions.
But in a moment, though, we're going to be talking about the taking down of statues here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Raslan, Uma Pagan, Umpike Pagan, and Ong Jo Lean here on A Bit of Culture, I should say. Topic number three is the taking down of statues. This is in light of the events in Charlottesville, Virginia, in America, which I thought everybody would know by now because lots of Nazis turned up and everything. I talked to Jolene before and she'd never heard of it.
No, I just needed a little reminder. Yeah, I just came back from a holiday, okay?
So, yeah, so anyway, there was a crisis there, a riot, because it was decided to take down a statue of Robert E. Lee, the General Robert E. Lee, and there was a clash between Nazis and non-Nazis. But in Kuala Lumpur, back in the 1920s, there was a statue of Sir Frank Swettenham put up near Masjid Jamek. Mm-hmm. And it stayed there for a very long time. Frank Swettenham, you really should know if you don't know, he's...
resident of Selangor.
Yep, and probably one of the top five most important people ever really to have lived in this land. He's made a big impact. And but at around the time of independence, I cannot find out exactly when, the statue was taken down and placed. It is now in the gardens of Museum Negara. If you think of statues in this country, I don't really think there are any. There's one perhaps of Queen Victoria in Georgetown in Penang, but the principle is that the theory being that it's against Islamic.
Don't worship idols.
No, I don't think it's just that. I mean, statues on their own are just statues, but where they're placed and how they're venerated, then they become monuments. And then monuments have a bigger meaning. So if the statue of Frank Swettenham from, a colonial officer, a high-ranking colonial officer, was in like a prominent place, a public place like Masjid Jame, then it's read as part of like something of a national monument. What are we trying to remember? What are we trying to memorialize? But when you place it in the museum grounds, then it's fine. We're not erasing history. Yes, this was part of our history, but we're not sort of, you know, expecting it as a public monument.
Well, that's the argument being made by right-wing people in America with Robert E. Lee. It's erasing history. They're saying you're erasing our history.
Move it to the History Museum of Racism over there. That's fun.
No, because I don't know quite what their argument would be, what Trump's argument would be, but these are all in the southern states, these statues.
Well, they say you're trying to wipe out southern culture.
Southern culture. But actually...
Is slavery part of southern culture then?
Well, exactly. Robert E. Lee fought for the cause of slavery. He was a slave owner himself.
And he lost. Losers don't get statues.
It is one of the few cases where the losing side have had statues. And one of the reasons being is because the statues were actually placed many years after the Civil War to show to the local black community, you think you won, you're wrong.
Yeah.
Actually...
The flags are still flying.
We're still here. We're still in charge because it's right in front of the courthouse.
So here's what I guess the conflict with the Malaysian side of it's quite interesting because, you know, we achieved independence relatively peacefully, aside from a few skirmishes here and there. And, you know, in the Indonesian context, where it was a lot more
bloody.
Yes, bloody. the immediate reaction post-independence is, yes, we will strip down everything that had to do with our colonial masters, right? And with us, I remember, I don't know if that's changed. I remember in our history books growing up, it was always, there was a great sense of pride in the fact that there was no blood spilled. But yet there's also another rhetoric that happens, I guess, on a governmental level, on a propaganda level, to reinforce this notion of, yes, we got rid of them and we got rid of our oppressors, etc., etc. And so we have a very interesting kind of dynamic with mm-hmm. our relationship with, it's not as clear cut as Indonesia, where it's like, get out, you bloody oppressors.
But I think what's missing from the discussion here then is that we have those two sides that you talk about, but we don't talk about how much are we being blinded by this vision that the British sold us during colonial times, that they were a benevolent colonizer, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, okay, fine. You know, if you want to compare in terms of like bloodshed, maybe less, but
But exploitation is still there.
It was there. And a lot of their structures have cast a shadow on our correct. Government policy still.
And with America, though, I mean, so, yeah, I mean, I have this conflicted relationship with statues, what to keep, what to go. With America, not so conflicted, because they'd done a study as to when these statues came up.
Mm.
And there's an interesting graph, and the vast majority of these statues came up during two very distinct periods, during the height of Jim Crow and during the civil rights movement.
So Jim Crow being the period in the 1910s and 20s.
When they implemented, you know, laws against black people.
With segregation.
With segregation, right? And then civil rights movement.
In the 60s.
So when white people were being challenged in the 60s, they felt, and so these statues aren't like 300 years old. They're very, very new.
No, I mean, it's giving the finger to black people.
Exactly.
But how about, though, just down south, across the causeway in Singapore?
Yeah, Raffles is still standing.
Raffles is still standing, not a problem.
And because the government does continue to still talk about Raffles as one of the founders of Singapore.
And why? I mean, I guess they have their own reasons. They want to have off the top of my head, I had a non-Malay history. I guess.
Maybe.
And also Raffles and the British would personify good civil service, well-managed society, perhaps.
And maybe it works to their advantage of positioning themselves as a hub and a port city.
And not like
this,
the rest of
Yeah, yeah, and this idea of a certain like internationalism, proximity to you know, international
And also, let's not forget, not like our neighbors that are all corrupt barbarians, right? You know? I mean, Singapore does have that view of, you know, oh, look, Indonesia, Malaysia, look at them. They're like animals, you know. Corruption is running rife. They can't manage society.
I've got to cut this off before we get into too much Singapore bashing.
No. But
there are cousins.
What about us and road names? So this one, I don't really know.
Yeah, I think road names are our statues.
Mm.
Wouldn't you say, Jolene?
Yeah.
I'm conflicted, actually, on the statue side.
Why are you conflicted with the statue side? Shouldn't we not erect monuments of people and things that symbolize oppression?
Well, no, I have a way of viewing history, which is that even if, all right, the ones with the Robert E. Lee in the South, I think that's I feel very clear about that.
That's a clear cut thing, right?
Because it's an open sore and it needs to be removed. But I would say that history has good and bad. But that notion of what is good will change dramatically over the next 5-10 years. It changes all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So a short while ago, it would have been seen to be correct to have a statue of whatever, but now it's not, and then a short while later it's changed. So I think it's important to note when that statue was made, what it was trying to say of that time. I think it's important to remember, be aware of that, because I think in Malaysia and in Southeast Asia in general, there is far too little history awareness, history making, that we are fully born right now.
And also we gauge goodness and badness by levels, right? Like if the amount of good you did outweighs the bad that's in you. So even when we let's take the most the purest examples of what we consider good, right? You ask anyone, who do you look up to? Oh, Gandhi, Nelson Mandela. You know, they got some bad sides too, which we don't talk about. And you know, and so, but we weigh it out. So we were like, yes, the goodness outweighs the bad. So we put up a statue, right?
I'm going to say one more statue, and I'm going to ask you to pass judgment, okay? Cecil Rhodes. Cecil Rhodes was an imperialist, a British man, an imperialist in the late 19th century. He went to Southern Africa, and he made an absolute fortune for himself in mining, especially diamond mining. And he carved out land. It's present-day Zimbabwe, and I believe also Tanzania. It's a huge piece of land, and he named it after himself. He called it Rhodesia. Now, there are statues of him on university campuses in South Africa, and also I think it's in Oxford University. And there are students who are now campaigning to have those statues taken down. By the way, Rhodes Scholars are because of him. He left an endowment. So I actually feel that those statues should remain, because it's important to remember that it did happen, and not just sort of by erasing it, we cleanse ourselves of any trace of what our forebears may have done.
But we should be able to, in our time, cast corrective lens and take corrective measures.
I agree, but unfortunately, the removal of something is an erasion. Is that a word?
Erasure?
It's an erasure. Great band from the 80s. So, you know, and it's a removal, it's an obliteration, and it's a forgetting. How can we?
So you're asking, how do we remember the bad stuff that Cecil Rhodes did if the statue of him is not around?
Pretty much.
You can't rely on history books, that's for sure, because governments are going to whitewash that as well.
Yeah. Well, put it in a museum. Then, things that are dead go to a museum.
Yeah, but even then, right?
Because strip it of its power.
You've got to go to the museum, and then human nature is of a kind that we're going to find new ways to oppress people and then return to it.
And he left so much money that, I mean, his endowments still will last for hundreds of years.
Yeah, and we're hoping that the Rhodes Scholars are going to be the ante of his legacy, right? Because we're hoping that they will study and become great people in society and undo all of the nasty stuff that he did. I mean, that's the hope, right?
Yeah, that wasn't his hope.
No, it wasn't his hope, but we think that might be the end consequence.
Maybe. Bill Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar, by the way. Okay, so I'm voting for letting the statue remain. You two?
Put it somewhere.
Put it somewhere.
Where it's like strip it of its power. Like a museum. Like a park. Or a museum. Or I don't know, put a label on it that says bad.
Okay. Uber?
I'm contextual. So with the case of Rhodes, I'd say leave it where it is. But, you know, if Adolf Hitler had a statue, I'd say tear it down.
Okay. So that brings us now to the final part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something that we think might be of interest. And so Uma's going first.
All right. I am going to recommend comics from Maple Comics, which is Amir Hafizi's outlet. So they were at KL Alternative Book Fest again this last weekend. Amir Hafizi and Maple Comics are like, it's just glutton for punishment, you know. Publishing comics in this, if you thought publishing books was hard, publishing comics is even harder because you have to work with artists and they don't necessarily believe in deadlines. And so it's very hard to get the product out there, but, you know, they're fighting the good fight and they're getting some really good stuff out there. And so, you know, there's a series of four-panel comics called Comic Ronyo, which is published on Facebook, and they've compiled it. They've got two volumes out of that at the moment. There are standalone stories, which are published by independent writers and artists. Everything from, you know, intimate family stories to outer space adventures. Yeah, and it's local, it's in English and BM, and it's good stuff. It's good reading, but a lot of people, I guess, don't know it's out there. So I think I'd urge you to go and check out their catalog, because I'm really enjoying it.
What's the comic market like in Malaysia? I would imagine it's quite good, isn't it?
Teeny tiny.
Really?
Teeny tiny.
The whole kind of Gila Gila and everything, you know, the legacy of?
A long time ago. Yeah, a long time ago, yes. I mean, in these days, even that satire is nowhere nearly as sharp as the glory days of Gila Gila. But also, I think it's a cost issue, right? So with Comic Ronyo, they're in like trade paperback editions, and they're not expensive. They're in Maple Comics, they're about $20 or $25, and that's the price range, $15 to $25. However, if you want to buy a Western comic, like a single issue is ringgit, and a collection can be now ringgit or ringgit because of the exchange rate. So it's a cost issue. People can't afford to buy, you know, you buy it's a 32-page comic for ringgit. That's a lot of money.
Okay.
So that's not helping the market at the moment. So these locally published comics, and I think ringgit is quite affordable, and you get good value out of it.
Okay. So what's it called again?
Maple Comics. It's spelt Maple, because I believe Registrar of Companies doesn't allow a little tick above the E, but it's pronounced Maple.
And where do you think you can buy it?
Oh, anyway. Kino has it. MPH has it. All good bookstores.
Okay. Ong Jolene.
Yes. To very simply Google this artist, Santiago Serra. He's done works where he hires or he uses people from the streets, people who are like drug addicts, the poor in his artwork. And so it's kind of very controversial. Of course, his stand is that he's just making visible the kind of oppression and the exploitation that we ourselves are guilty of, that we're, you know, implicated, like we're all part of. So yeah, just very quick, simple Google and you'll...
The name again?
Santiago Serra.
I get the impression from what little I know that the Philippines art scene is incredibly vibrant and very good.
It is, it is. And then if I can add one more, just look up this book by Doreen Fernandez. It's called Why Sinigang? Sinigang is one of the national dishes of the Philippines, but slightly lesser known to adobo, which I think you all have heard of.
Yeah.
And she talks about how sinigang is very adaptable. You can put pork in it or chicken or fish. And, you know, if you're poor, you can sort of tweak the ingredients. And if you want to go like all high class and fancy. Yeah. And then it talks about rice as well. And I think, you know, like we were talking about how we share food places and eating in Malaysia and then how things could be separate. So that could be in a more oblique relation.
Is it my imagination? Have you come back with a slight Filipino inflection in your accent?
Really? Talaga? Yeah. Yeah.
The slightest.
We're Malaysian. That's what we do.
Okay. So my recommendation is, I can't think of anything else because it's just been on my mind and nothing else has been. Since this whole thing in Charlottesville, came up, there's this one song that keeps going through my mind. Because it has the line to Robert E. Lee, I'll show it. It's Roxy Music's Virginia Plain from their first magnificent album, Remake Remodel. And Roxy Music stars the great Brian Ferry and the perhaps even greater Brian Eno twiddling away on his synthesizers back in the early 1970s. They were contemporaries of David Bowie. You know, their first three albums, the first two albums especially, magnificent. And so Virginia Plain is... I guess my recommendation is go listen to Virginia Plain because it mentions Robert E. Lee and it mentions Virginia. Producer Ali says we can play out with it, which is great because it's a fantastic song. So my recommendation is the first album by Roxy Music, Remake Remodel, which features the fantastic song Virginia Plain.
I will go check it out.
And so it only remains for me now to thank special honored guest, Ong Jolene.
Oh, see you next year.
Yeah, because you're going away, aren't you?
Yes, yes.
To go study... curating.
In Amsterdam.
Okay, it's all right for some.
I'll come back with a new accent.
I look forward to that one. And Uma Pagan Ampeke Pagan, you're not going anywhere?
No, I'm not, but I was going to say thank you in my best Dutch accent, but I can't. So, thanks, Cam.
Okay. me, Cam Rastan, if you'd like to get in touch with us, please do so. You'd have to write a email letter to Ong Jolene. Like our Facebook page, where things actually sort of do happen now, actually, a little bit. Well, maybe I'm overselling it. But anyway, so please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Losers shouldn't get statues.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.